Okay, welcome to the NTNU International Taiwan Study Center podcast. We're back, and today is as special as it always is, but in some ways even more so, because this is the first time that I've ever done a podcast forward in time. By that, I mean we're welcoming a special guest, Craig Smith, who is Associate Professor at the Asia Institute at the University of Melbourne. And you're 3 hours ahead of me, Craig, which normally I think I've only ever done online with Europe, with Africa, with America. But yes, Craig, it's a pleasure to have you on the podcast. Thanks for joining us. You're a person with a lot of experience from around the world, but not least in Taiwan. I know you've lived here for around 12 years.
Yeah, something like that, off and on again, because I came and left, and I keep going back almost every year, but sometimes I stick around for a few years.
Taiwan's like that, isn't it? It draws you back in. You can never quite escape.
Never escape, yeah.
Great. Well, I know that you've been in Taiwan, and actually you've been at NTNU last year. And I was wondering if you could fill us in a little bit on what you were doing here this most recent time that you were back.
Yeah, I proposed a research proposal for the Taiwan Fellowship that's run out of the National Central Library, and managed to do close to 6 months in Taiwan working on this, mostly in the capital, but I was down in Tainan for a couple months as well. I'm in translation studies, which is kind of a strange niche field. Really, I'm a historian, so I did my PhD in history. And this project that I'm working on is looking at Taiwan history through translators. So I look at translators and interpreters. So some chapters are on a single person, and then some chapters are on a group of people or a period of time. And basically what it ends up showing is a story of changing language and power throughout Taiwan history. Because of course, you go back to the 17th, 18th, 19th centuries, and there's loads of information on the interpreters with indigenous peoples interpreting usually between Taiwanese, Hokkien, and indigenous languages. But then, of course, the Japanese arrive, and I'm sure you're familiar with the stories of changing dynamics of language and power. And the Japanese had to learn Hokkien, and the Taiwanese had to learn Japanese. And slowly we see Japanese having more and more power. And then, of course, post-World War II, the situation changes again. I'm sure everyone is familiar with how policies in the 1950s began to ban Japanese outright and make everybody study Mandarin. So there's a long story of translation and interpreting behind this. And those individuals are really interesting because sometimes they held power. And you can see their power and agency. Sometimes they worked as agents of empire, and sometimes they really worked to help the people. And the power dynamics between the languages often indicated to what level they could have agency or what level they could help different groups of people. So it's a complicated story, but it really is Taiwan history.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds really fascinating. One little comment that you made there that I just want to bring out for a moment before we carry on with the kind of the direction of things. You said the Japanese had to learn Taiwanese or Taiyu or Taiwanese Hokkien or lots of names. How far did the Japanese go in learning Taiwanese? Did they really have to just for the sake of governing? Were the Taiwanese much more forced to learn Japanese than the Japanese bothered to learn Taiwanese? How was the power dynamics?
Good question. So when the Japanese arrived, they brought with them this cohort of interpreter translators that had been trained at the Imperial University in Tokyo. But of course, nobody was studying Hokkien, never mind Taiwanese Hokkien, at the university. They were studying Mandarin. So they were shocked when they arrived and there were almost no Mandarin speakers. They found that the Qing officials who did speak Mandarin had, a lot of them had left in the 1890s. Those who did stay were very important in the beginnings of Japanese rule. But right away, the Japanese government and the Ministry of Education realized they had to start studying Taiwanese. So beginning in 1894 and really accelerating in 1895, so right at the very beginnings of the Japanese taking over, you see lots of books published in Japan on Daiki, Taiwanese. And that's the word that they use at the time, Taigo or Taiwango. So it was really important to learn. And one of the reasons for that was they didn't trust the former Qing officials who were acting as go-betweens. Especially with the courtroom interpreting, you get these really amazing images of multiple translators. So somebody was brought to court, and there were a lot of court cases right at the beginning of Japanese rule, right? So the people who were accused were speaking in Hokkien, and you had the former Qing dynasty official translating that into Mandarin, and then you had Japanese interpreters translating Mandarin into Japanese. And so once you have multiple interpreters, you've got a serious issue, right? What about the police? What do the police do? Do they have to have multiple interpreters? So a lot of young Japanese moved in with Taiwanese families. The Taiwanese families were reimbursed for this. And within about 10 years, you had a very small number of Japanese who were fluent in Taiwanese.
Was this an official government policy to encourage Japanese to move in with Taiwanese families for the sake of learning the actual language on the ground?
I don't think it was an official government policy. I think it was enabled by the government. As some of the Japanese who came over were only 16 or 17 years old, but at that time they were seen as adults and they already had positions within the colonial government. And it was a minority. Most Japanese, of course, did not learn the local language, at least not right away. Those who were born in Taiwan, they did. So there was a little bit of, you know, this was going both ways. Japanese were really learning Taiwanese.
That's fascinating. And that fits in with your narrative that you're talking about, where there's power and there's agency in translation, and it does go both ways. One other thing that you were bringing out, I know, with this project was about inter-Asian translation, as opposed to just focusing on European to Asian languages, and Taiwan as a center of inter-Asian translation. You've touched on that a bit. Would you be able to expand on that?
Yeah, definitely. So one thing is I wasn't really that interested in looking at English in Chinese, sure, or English in Japanese. But most people who do the history of translation, they do focus on that. You know, Henrietta Harrison had a very popular book about 2 years ago on Qing Dynasty translator and translator interpreters. And of course, she was looking at English and Chinese. But I think historians are well aware that really for Chinese history, Japanese was much more important for most of the 20th century and definitely the late 19th century. Most things that were translated into Chinese were translated from Japanese. So a lot of books that were translated from English and German into Japanese were then translated from Japanese into Chinese. So inter-Asian translation already was crucial for China and for Japan. In Taiwan itself, if you look at the hundreds of years of interpreting history that we have documentation for, it's a lot of it's about in indigenous languages. So training Han Chinese to learn indigenous languages and working with those indigenous peoples, often young women who were coming down into the Han Chinese villages, they were learning Hokkien and sometimes Hakka. So really, European languages don't really have as much importance until the Americans arrived post-World War II. And so my book that I'm working on right now is probably going to finish up around 1960 when English becomes increasingly dominant.
Okay. And when you were talking about the importance in China in the late 19th and 20th century of Japanese literature and that was translated into Chinese, was Taiwan a facilitator of that translation in any way?
Absolutely. So Taiwanese translators were, of course, right from the beginning, they were more fluent in written Chinese, especially classical Chinese and Japanese. So in the early 20th century, there were a lot of interpreters and translators. Some of them went over to China to learn Mandarin, And once they learned, they would, of course, learn Mandarin faster than the Japanese. Once they learned Mandarin, they could act as interpreters for Japanese who were working all over China. I mean, there was a huge need for interpreter translators. And as you get further into the colonial period, the trust of Japanese colonizers for Taiwanese goes up and up. So trust is another really important part of this narrative. Who trusts who? The beginning of the colonial period, they didn't trust the local interpreters and the local translators. So that was why they needed to get Japanese educated in local languages. Later, as they trust them more and more, you can see the Taiwanese are given more important positions within Taiwan, but also in China.
Right. And that leads nicely on to an article you wrote about a guy called Zhang Wojun.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of start that out by talking of trying to leave behind the simplistic patriot versus collaborator labels that would get applied to translators like him. That must be quite difficult. How do you go about trying to get rid of those labels and bring out some of the real complexity and nuance of what it must have been like for Taiwanese translators at that time in China, working with or maybe against the Japanese through their translation?
Yeah, well, this is something I've thought about quite a lot, but a lot of my previous work was connected more to China and 1930s, 1940s China-Japan relations. And this kind of narrative of you're either a patriot or you're a collaborator was really common in the wartime period and post-war period to try and understand not just translator interpreters, but anybody who worked with the Japanese. So after the war, you had to find out who was a Hanjian, who was a traitor to the Chinese people, and who was a patriot who fought against the Japanese. And of course, for the last 30 or 40 years, many historians have been trying to question this and say, you know, we don't understand the particular context that these people were living in. I mean, were they supporting the Japanese to try and help their own people? Were they working towards peace? Were they trying to save their own family? Things were very complicated. So there's been a long discussion in history that for a while played out in the Journal of Asian Studies about whether or not historians should be judging people in these circumstances. And this is still actually, you know, a lot of historians think, yeah, we should be judging all these people. They did some terrible things. And then still you have a lot of historians who are saying, no, it's not the historian's role to do that. I kind of think that sometimes you can't help judging, but you have to also respect that these people were not doing things to create misery or to hurt the Chinese population. They were doing probably what they thought was best at the time. And yeah, some of them were trying to make money. It was hard times. So it's a complicated situation. And then you complicate things further by throwing Taiwan into the situation. Because
yeah,
when we're talking about Taiwanese people in the 30s and 40s, what does it mean to say you're a patriot? So I look at Zhang Wojun, and Zhang Wojun is a really interesting character. He was friends with all of the revolutionaries, or the Taiwan, pro-Taiwan revolutionaries in the 20s and 30s. But he moved to China and got a job working, teaching Japanese in Beijing, and became a very influential translator, mostly of socialist Japanese literature. So sometimes he's really pro-Japan, like he really loved Japan. And he became very pro-China when he was living in China. And at the same time, he often talked about how much he loved Taiwan. So sometimes when he talks about my country, I found that it depended what audience he was speaking to. So he used my country to refer to China, Japan, and Taiwan at different times in his writings. So there's a lot of ambiguity there. And
yeah,
it's all about the historical context that he lived in. And I don't think we can really judge him for that.
And yet, of course, history, I guess it always does judge in some ways. And in terms of his memory, I assume then he must be remembered rather differently between Taiwan, China, and Japan.
Yes. Yeah. It's kind of interesting because, like many families, his family was broken up during the Civil War. And he came back to Taiwan with one of his sons. His older son ended up staying in Beijing. And then 20 years later, both the son in Taiwan and the son in Beijing edited a volume about their father's writings. So it's really interesting to contrast these because, you know, this was 1970s. So whether you're in Taiwan or in China, you really had to say you were a Chinese patriot. So they really both emphasize how much he loved China, but from different sides of the straits, and very different picture. So the other side of things is that in Taiwan, he really provided a great contribution to the rise of Taiwan literature. In the 1920s, he was living between, sometimes in Beijing. He actually came back to Taiwan for about a year and a half, where he edited the Taiwan Minbao, one of the most important journals in Taiwan. And so he brought in a lot of that May 4th knowledge. And he was one of the first to be really, really critical of traditional Taiwan literature and promoted the ideas of new Taiwan literature. So you have the rise of people like Lai He around that time. Jiang Wojun contributed to all that. But also he said that Taiwan literature is a stream of the greater body of Chinese literature. And at the time, that was not such a big deal to say. But looking back from the perspective of Taiwan literature, of course, these days, people might not like some of his ideas quite as much. But you have to understand who he was, where he was living. For him, he wanted to see Taiwan get autonomy from Japan, right? Japan was the major imperial power, not China. So we have to take his writings in context. So yeah, I'm really interested in historical memory and how we remember people like him today. So that's a big part of my book as well. I look at how some of these really famous translator interpreters were remembered and are remembered. And Jiang Wojun, he used to have a statue, a big bust in Banqiao, in front of the Banqiao Middle School. And I went to see it a few years ago. It was established in, I think, the mid-90s by what at right. that point would have been the Taipei Xian government.
Sure. Taipei yeah. County government, yeah.
Taipei County government, yeah. Yeah, of course, now it's Xinbei. So they had put this huge bust out there, and it was there for a couple decades. And then one day I went to see it, and it's gone. So I asked at the school, and they said, oh, it was removed. I said, why was it removed? And they couldn't find any documentation on why it was removed. And they showed me where it was. They were really good to me. They walked me around the school, and behind the gymnasium, there's a little patch where it's full of air conditioner units, an area that the students and the teachers would never go. And there was this big, beautiful bust of Jiang Wojun. I thought it's really symbolic of how historical memory changes, how you can go from being on the main street to being hidden behind an old gymnasium.
with all the air conditioning fans.
Yeah.
Wow.
It would be interesting if they had a whole collection of statues back there, but his was the only one.
Okay. So yeah. Interesting that they didn't relegate him to the park that all the Chiang Kai-shek statues have gone.
No, I guess he wouldn't really fit in well there either.
Yeah. Another kind of feature which I guess we could also use Jiang Wojun to bring in is the concept of Asianism. Reading the article, that was fascinating that you talk about the way in which people of those times could use the concept of Asianism, of Asia versus the colonial powers of Europe and America, to argue for autonomy from Japan. You know, we're equal as Asian partners in this. While at the same time, the Japanese started to use the idea as, we'll take you all over and become powerful so we can fight the nasty people from the West. And I guess that is something which comes into it when you're trying to interpret the work of people like Jiang Wojun. Of what does he mean when he's talking about some of these Asianist ideas?
Yeah. So Asianism has been my focus for 20 years now. I guess I've been writing on Asianism. And it started when I was a master's student in Taiwan. and I was reading about Jiang Wojun. So this article that I recently published is actually my return to how I started studying Asianism. So I started studying it from the Taiwanese perspective. And, you know, Asianism was basically the idea that Asian countries must unite to fight against the West, which in the late 19th century and early 20th century was pretty united when they were fighting against Asian countries, right? So the Western countries all supported each other in imperialism. So the only way that Asian countries could fight back was if they too could unite and work together. And that can mean a lot of different things. But of course, as you mentioned, you know, in the Japanese example, this was often used to support ideas of imperialism and the invasion of China, the control of Taiwan and Korea, these kind of things. In Japan itself, there was always different factions. There were always people who opposed what the government was doing and used Asianism to critique the government. And the government itself didn't actually use ideas of Asianism until pretty late in the war. The government didn't like the idea of Asianism at first. So Asianism went from being an anti-government thing to being accepted and turned on its head by the Japanese government. So it can be imperialist or it can be anti-imperialist. And in the Taiwanese context, some Taiwanese writers in the 1920s were really keen to use it as a way to find more autonomy within the Japanese empire. So Jiang Weishui, who's maybe the most famous intellectual from the 1920s, he worked right away to republish Sun Yat-sen's speech on Great Asianism, which was in 1924. And he thought that Asianism could show a future in which Asian countries were united in some respects, but had autonomy in other respects. So he wrote quite a bit about Asianism in the 20s, seeing Taiwan kind of as the center. You know, he said, China and Japan have to work together if we're going to fight against Western imperialism. And the only way China and Japan is going to work together is if you get the Taiwanese involved, because the Taiwanese understand China, the Taiwanese understand Japan. So he saw that kind of liminal position stuck between China and Japan as a real advantage in working towards peace in East Asia and peace globally. Jiang Wojun also subscribed to some of these ideas when they worked together on the Taiwan Minbao in 1924, 1925, 1926.
That's a great statement. If you want Japan and China to work together, you've got to involve the Taiwanese.
Well, Taiwan still today is between China and Japan. I don't know what role Taiwanese people can really play in bringing peace, but there's still no doubt about it. Taiwan is pivotal for the peace of China, Japan, and
yes,
state in general.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, I was refraining from saying, oh, it's so relevant now because it's quite a different context. But like you say, the pivotal nature of Taiwan's position is just as significant. Certainly, you've put it much nicer than I was thinking of.
Thanks.
Craig, this is brilliant. As we kind of come into land, maybe just looking at the wider field of Taiwan studies, you mentioned at the beginning, it's quite a niche field that you're looking at. But how do you see that as contributing to the wider development of Taiwan studies and beyond?
Well, yeah, I think translation studies is a niche field, but I think what I'm doing, you know, history connected to language is crucial for Taiwan. We can't separate Taiwan from all these battles over language that have been going on for hundreds of years, right? Through indigenous languages, through Hokkien, Hakka, Japanese, and Mandarin in particular, and then, of course, English post-World War II. But even these days, you know, the way Taiwan has attempted to embrace Vietnamese in schools and other languages as well, including Thai and Indonesian, absolutely amazing. I don't think we've really seen it successful yet, but the interest that's going into this and the interest that's going into returning to indigenous languages and supporting them is something that I think the whole world can learn from. You know, I live in Australia now, and Australia has lots of advantages, but in terms of language, it's often accused of being monolingual. And it's not a monolingual country at all. It's a monolingual state, but a multilingual population because most of us were immigrants from all over the place. And there always have been many different indigenous languages, just like in Taiwan. But the government has not given support to the languages that we have here in the way that Taiwan has. And I think the people of Taiwan have really realized that language is one of the things that gives Taiwan power, is one of the advantages Taiwan has. And that's why now they say, all right, if your parents are Vietnamese, learn Vietnamese in school. Great, we'll support it. That's such a smart thing. We should be building on our multicultural and multilingual populations and using them as an advantage. And I think Taiwan's starting to do that. Taiwan's history has contributed to that. And I think writing about this history of language and power is good for other countries, but it's important for us to understand what happened in Taiwan. And in terms of Taiwan studies, really where I want to see Taiwan studies going in the future is more about looking at Taiwan's influence around the world, Taiwan, what I call global Taiwan. And language is part of that, but there's a lot more going on. You know, the new southbound policy, Taiwan's connections with Japan, Taiwan's connections with China. And right now, I'm really interested in Taiwan's connections with South America and Latin America, which are just fascinating and constantly changing.
Yeah. And just before we started recording, you were talking about Taiwan's connections with India related to language and Taiwan as a model.
Yeah, I would like to see in the future we use Taiwan as method. And like I was telling you earlier, I've met some people in India using Taiwan and Taiwan's language policy and its changing dynamics to criticize the Indian government's push for Hindi as a national language. So we've got a lot to learn from Taiwan around the world in applying Taiwan as method to not just other Asian countries, but places all over the world to critique our own governments.
That's a brilliant summary. Thank you so much, Craig. It's been a pleasure to talk to you. And I think we've come to a place that the future does have hope. So you've shown us something of that. So thank you so much.
Thanks, Josh. I've always got a lot of hope for Taiwan.
So that was Professor Craig Smith from the Asia Institute at the University of Melbourne. Thanks again for listening. Hope you've enjoyed this episode. And a little reminder that you can go back to enjoy our back catalogue of some wonderful interviews with people from all around the world involved in Taiwan studies. Don't forget as well that you can sign up to the International Taiwan Study Center newsletter from NTNU here in the show notes below. Thank you very much. Goodbye for now.